Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to Senator Lynn Ruane.
I think that's what makes me the saddest. I don't regret a lot of things in my life because I think, you know, we make the decisions that get us to where we are. And luckily, I'm not on drugs and I'm not in prison and I'm not dead. So I have to respect and accept the decisions that I made through life. But when my daughters hit certain ages, I felt incredibly sad for myself as a teenager. Okay. I didn't feel sadness at the time. So it's definitely a sadness I'm implanting on it now with, like, I think there's teenage years I missed out on in terms of innocence, in terms of not having to worry about things. And I won't ever really know what that's like to have, you know. So I do look at some other kids that are living more like age appropriate lives at the ages that they are. And I kind of think, you know, I wonder what that was like.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Lynn lives in Killinarden and Talla with her two daughters, Jordan, who's 22, and Jaylin, who's 15. And in this conversation, she talks about her childhood, experimenting with drugs from the age of 12, finding out she was pregnant at 15, and how a community education initiative called An Cusann, developed by Catherine Zappone and the late Anne-Louise Gilligan, helped her massively in life. She's been a senator for 6 years now and recently completed a master's in creative writing, and she was the dream to chat to. She cares deeply, she's inquisitive, authentic and refreshingly honest. And I started by asking her about a recent project with an unlikely partner, actor of stage and screen, the one and only Miriam Margolyes.
Yeah, I think it's odd in the sense that we're like an unlikely couple, but yet we're both have similar energy levels in the world. So it's like there's no even balancing out there of that energy. Like, okay, you know, so it's kind of like this could be really good, like, or really, really dangerous. So we done a documentary which will air in April about Lady Gregory.
Oh yeah.
The founder of the Abbey.
Very good.
So as part of that, we obviously traveled together to the west of Ireland and different places that would be, I suppose, places where Lady Gregory was.
Like Coole Park and
yes.
All that. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So we get to see it on what channel?
RTE.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's their spring kind of catalogue next year, which it was really amazing to work with her. So Miriam Margolyes is like, you know, this summer was standing in the garden in Killinarden Estate and driving around Killinarden in a camper van, you know, and it was just brilliant. Yeah. It was brilliant. It brought an awful lot of energy and as well as the fun as well. Like Miriam has so many layers, so you learn so much from her. So you're kind of moving in and out of having the crack and then just actually, you know, getting to see who she is on a day-to-day basis and just how actually, like, how politically aligned we are.
Both backgrounds.
Very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
But very much the same kind of...
Fundamentals. That's very cool because, like, what we know of her, she's done an amazing body of work, but, like, whenever we see her, say, on the likes of Graham Norton or whatever, she's just brilliantly unfiltered.
Yes.
That, and it's so refreshing.
It is refreshing, and it's in honesty. You know what I mean? It's like, how many of us are so authentically ourselves in every day? We all have a public life, a private life. They're not synonymous to each other.
Yeah.
You know, we want to pretend that who we are out there in the world is exactly who we are at home, but, like, that's not true. But I think it might be true for Miriam Margolyes. I think if you're going to get right to the heart of, like, an authentic life, I think she has it. You know, I think she's extremely honest and transparent.
But isn't that you too?
I hope so. I think to a degree. I mean, I definitely think for me, though, I definitely probably filter some things I say to an extent. But I think we are similar. I don't filter them in terms of lie about them, but I definitely probably package things. I've probably
probably all do that, don't we?
You know, I package things. So I'm quite honest, but I try and how do I deliver that honesty? You know, where I don't think she ever thinks about how she delivers the honesty. She just delivers the honesty.
Okay,
do you know what I mean?
You.
I think that's kind of the difference.
Yeah. You're getting to do really interesting work at the moment, like separate to politics. Because you've had a fascinating few years, and initially when you became senator, obviously, you know, everybody wanted to talk to you. You were on TV shows, journalists wanted to talk to you because of, I suppose, where you came from and where you had come to. It seemed like it was such a juicy story for the media business, you know. But right now, you know, you have your master's in creative writing. You're doing a lot of very creative work now. It's
yeah.
Very interesting.
So, like, when I was really, really young, I wanted to be a writer.
Okay, that was the dream.
Yeah, that was the dream. And I had my typewriter and I would, you know, sellotape pages together and give stories out in the house and, you know, joined Ina Blyton's fan club and didn't realise she was dead. So my mom taught me to read very, very young.
Yeah.
And she bought me a book every week. So we went, before the square existed, you'd get the little local link bus down to Kilimana and she'd buy me a Ladyboard book and she said I would have it read on the bus on the way home and then I would read it over and over and over and over again. So she had to advance me up through books at a very young age. So my imagination was always there. My ability to observe, I think it's like there's creativity, but I think I have, what I'm learning about myself is that I have a great ability to observe a lot of things happening around me all at once and thread the narrative between them together. So I retain a lot of information and I've used that in a creative way to be able to then capture snapshots, I think, of people's lives through writing or through storytelling or through, you know, conversations.
Yes. You seem to me to be somebody who's very inquisitive and investigative about things. Like even when I was, you know, I suppose doing a little bit of research ahead of chatting to you and, you know, I suppose where you came from and I suppose access to drugs was... It was freely available. And am I right in thinking that, I don't know, 14, 15, you got your hands on heroin, but instead of actually, okay, I'm going to experiment with this because I've been dabbling in other drugs, I'm going to go head down to the library and I'm going to learn about it.
Yeah. I think there's probably a few parts of my character that comes together in that scenario is one of them being wanting to understand the drug because I was observing, like all of us were observing, the kind of impact of heroin around us. I think maybe the fact that I was reading so much and from so young, it made me not afraid to learn a little bit more about things at the time, rather than just take things at face value. So even in school, I was very inquisitive. I would have been called disruptive.
Yeah.
But I was actually just quite eager to know more.
Yeah.
I was the kid that was the why, you know, so you kind of wanted to shut me up, you know, so you could get on with your curriculum. With heroin, I really wanted to use heroin, you know, but I also was quite conscious that there was a lot of stuff happening in the community at the time and people were struggling and I could see they were opening methadone services. I don't think all, like, you know, early teenagers are observant to that extent.
I wouldn't think so.
No, but But I did. I think it was just a natural characteristic. I don't know whether I developed it or it's something that you're born with, that you are just taking in your surroundings all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, nowadays we can go to the phone and we can type something into Google and find the information, but you had to go to the library.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fascinating when you think about it, because am I right in thinking you actually had the heroin, like the heroin, do you hear me? But you had it on you while you were going into the library to read up about it.
Yeah, like, I mean, and there was many times I was around heroin before and after that, but that one was quite secretive at the time, actually, because I think I remember me and my friend discussing that we would get it together, and then she seemed to kind of back off from that, and then I went and got it anyway, and then I backed off from that. Some of our friends were already using heroin. I would have already seen people use heroin in front of me, both intravenously and smoking. But that was the first time, I suppose, and I don't understand either why I removed myself from the group from it either, because so many of us were doing things in a groupish kind of way.
Mm.
But there was something in me that was being a little bit secretive about, well, if I'll try it, I won't tell any of them that I've tried it. And my other friend seems to not, I don't know if she really wants to anymore. But then I went to the library, and I remember reading books that I didn't really understand, actually.
Yeah, well, what age are you getting? 14.
I was about 13, 14. You know, so I didn't really actually, I can remember walking into the library, and the kids, I remember even where those type of books were, because it wasn't a part of the library I'd ever been in before, because they were adult books, they were science books, they were, you know, they were about addiction. They weren't a genre that I'd had to look for before.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember they were to the left of the old, the library has been kind of done up since then, but I remember them being to the left, and I remember sitting down and reading them and not truly understanding all the words. But I remember reading about methadone at that time, and, you know, methadone being used as a substitute for heroin, and how, you know, and then I was like, well, there's something about this that tells me that I will be fully under the control of this drug. So I think there's another element of my character. I think there's a lot of luck as well, but there's another element of my character that I think likes to be in control.
Okay.
So yeah. I don't like the unknown. You know, I don't like sitting in the unknown. I'd rather face the reality of something, even if it's really, really terrible, rather than not really know what's going on. So I was like, I think heroin is going to remove my ability to be in control.
Yeah.
And I wanted control more than I wanted the absence of control, you know? So but then what's really silly is, when I look back now, is I was street buying methadone and taking methadone, which I could have just been, I could have become equally as addicted to, because it's just an opioid substitute. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was like, I was doing these really sound logical things while also showing the sheer naivety as well of me as a child, you know. So he didn't take heroin, but was like drinking methadone on the street. Do you know what I mean? Or, you know,
yeah,
so
I getcha.
It's kind of, So I wasn't like this model child that was like, oh, I knew what heroin was and I didn't do it. Something stopped me doing heroin, but I was still doing something else that I could have easily just ended up with the same dependency to. So there was kind of contradictions, I suppose, in my young self. Yeah.
Did you think, like, look, this is a safer drug for me to use? Like, heroin is the biggie, as it were.
Yeah, I think it was just the association, where methadone seemed like medicine and heroin seemed like a street drug, or
right,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? So, like, maybe it was, I just had more chance of, and you wouldn't have had access to methadone in the same way that you would heroin. So, you know, to get methadone, you, at that time, with me being so young as well, I would have had to know someone that was selling methadone. And most people obviously were on methadone for their own use, but they would reduce themselves, say, down from, you know, 60 mils or 25 mils to 10 mils, and they'd live off 10 mils, and then they'd sell the rest of their methadone, not even usually to make money, but sometimes to help other people, because the list for the clinics were so long that people were trying to help each other in terms of having access to methadone instead of using heroin. So the times that I took methadone, I just happened to be with somebody else that had methadone. I wasn't seeking it out as such.
Yeah. And, like, in terms of other drugs, you had been dabbling in cannabis as well.
Cannabis, E, cocaine, speed.
Yeah.
Yeah. The lot.
The lot.
And benzos tablets and stuff. Yeah.
And, like, this kicked off at what age?
I'd say 12. It's always hard. I try and remember that transition from junior school to senior school. you know, not junior school, it's from primary school to secondary school, yeah. And just kind of a loop in there where a lot of stuff began to happen very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I suppose this is where, for somebody like me, when I'm listening to you, it's, I'm going to be totally honest, very different
yes.
from what I experienced myself. That wasn't my reality at that age. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And that was the reality of the community in which you were living.
Yeah. And many, many within the community, but there's other people within the same community, because we're quite large communities, that wouldn't have
yeah.
had the same experience as me. So, you know, it's like, for me, it's like some air communities have a higher concentration of these experiences, but it's not everybody's experience. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's definitely a higher concentration. The likelihood is higher. There's statistically more people that will end up in, you know, because of poverty and drug use or crime or all those different things. But it's not everybody's experience.
Yeah. And to get the drugs, there was also, you know, other stuff happening, as in you've spoken about it quite publicly before, that you did actually have to rob.
Yes.
To get money to buy the drugs.
Yes.
So like, life was just, were you a bit unhinged at the time, do you think?
I think at the time I was enjoying myself yeah. to some extent okay, as okay. well. Like, you know. Yeah.
Was it a buzz?
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's, I know it's like when you look back and, you know, I robbed from shops and from, I remember it was Roach's stores at the time, was in the square long, long time ago. And you'd be robbing perfumes and Levi's and that kind of thing. But there was also a sense of achievement sometimes in that as well, because I wasn't achieving in school any longer. I didn't like being there. And regardless of what the activity is, we often want to feel like we're good at something, or we're providing for ourselves, or that we're using our brain in a particular way. And sometimes, unfortunately, that's in a way that's, you know, society would say is wrong, and the laws would say is wrong. And they are, obviously, you know, in terms of shoplifting and stuff. But I'd say at that young age, I also felt like I was good at something.
Yeah, I can do this.
Yeah.
I'm getting away with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you're in the library and you go, nah, not for me. You flush it down the loo in the library.
Mm.
Wow. And heroin is never something that you
go to again.
Right.
I did not think about it again. Like, I mean, okay. I did think about it.
But whatever you read scared you.
Or it gave me some perspective.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say it gave me just some perspective that, and I always gave myself permission, I think, even at a young age, to go, you're just not doing it right now. Like, so sometimes when you deny yourself something, it's sometimes as a young person, like, you know, it's like with sweets, or if there's a can of Coke in the fridge and tell your child not to go near it or whatever. If you deny yourself something, sometimes the relationship with it can become really excruciating.
Yeah.
So I think, like, to kind of telling yourself that, you know, I don't really know enough about this. I don't know if it's going to ruin my life or not. So I'm just not going to do it right now. But I may have different information on it, you know, further down the line. Do you know?
Yeah.
So you're nearly just creating a different type of less strainful relationship with the idea of not doing something. You're giving yourself permission that you actually could change your mind, but not right now.
That's unbelievably mature, isn't it, at that age?
Yeah.
To be having that kind of dialogue almost with yourself about it. Yeah.
But the thing is, at the time, I wouldn't have realized that that was the dialogue. And I think that that's what's important, is it's easy when you get older to retrospectively
yeah.
put them thoughts on, like, they wouldn't have been as in-depth as that at the time. Do you know what I mean? So I wouldn't have sat down and spent a half an hour going and saying it, like, in a clear way that I'm communicating it now. Mm. It would have been much more quick decisions, like, nah, Jays, I don't really know what that's all about, so maybe I shouldn't use it. And then you're kind of off again to something else. So the depth and the layers kind of get built on later on, and you can see, you know, when you're older and you're retrospectively kind of reflecting on your life, you're, well, why would I make that decision and not that decision? And you can put bit more of a vocab on it. I definitely wouldn't have had the same vocabulary sure. on it that I am now.
Yeah. So, like, again, you know, I said you were very mature, but I suppose you were extremely streetwise, because you had to be.
Yes.
You had to be. And that was probably the difference. Like, if you were to look at me at the same age, say, if we were to have a young Lynn and a young Sheila, you would run rings around me because I would have been so young.
Yeah.
And childlike, I suppose. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's what makes me the saddest. I don't regret a lot of things in my life because I think, you know, we make the decisions that get us to where we are. And luckily, I'm not on drugs and I'm not in prison and I'm not dead. So I have to respect and accept the decisions that I made through life. But when my daughters hit certain ages, I felt incredibly sad for myself as a teenager. Okay. I didn't feel sadness at the time. So it's definitely a sadness I'm implanting on it now. Like, I think there's teenage years I missed out on in terms of innocence, in terms of okay. not having to worry about things. And I won't ever really know what that's like to have, you know. So I do look at some other kids that are living more like age appropriate lives at the ages that they are. And I kind of think, you know, I wonder what that was like.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
That's the thing, I suppose, you know, life experiences shape us.
They do.
And if you're catapulted into experiencing kind of the frenzy of drug taking, whatever it is, at a young age, unfortunately, yeah, your innocence is taken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's okay. Like, it's not stuff I think I've done enough
work on yourself.
Work over the years that I'm in a good place with that stuff. Do you know what I mean? Because I also like, if you were to separate adult me from, like, you know, the child me and look and go, I'm also extremely proud of how that child navigated life. And I'm also extremely proud how that child ensured that the adult me continued to advocate for anyone that's ever had experiences like me.
Well, that's it.
Do you know?
Yeah, look what you're doing.
Yeah.
Look how you're making a difference.
Yeah. So even though I can have a moment of, oh God, like, what would it have been like if Lynn didn't have to experience those things? You know, I can think about that for a moment and recognize it, but I'll still step, I suppose, straight back into the stronger position, which is, well, here we are now and what are we doing? You know?
Yeah. And I suppose a huge turning point as well in terms of where your life perhaps might have gone was you were in a relationship. You and your boyfriend found out that you were pregnant.
Yes.
And you were 15 at the time.
Yes.
So again, young, probably not planned, but yet, lots of positives came from that.
Yeah, not planned, but not protected either. You know what I mean? So there's kind of a fine line in there like whether I was overly worried about getting pregnant or not, you know?
Yeah.
And I just stepped into pregnancy like it was meant to be, like I wasn't 15, which is, again, like, I was driving my daughter, my youngest girl is in transition year and... So she gets her junior cert results tomorrow. But I was driving her to her junior cert a few months back before this, whenever it was, but I can't even remember now. It's been that long since she said it. But when she was sitting her junior cert, we're driving in the car and she looked at me and she said, Jesus, Ma, you were like 8 months pregnant when you were going to do your junior cert. And it was kind of like, what the hell? Like, she was saying to me, what the hell is that like? Do you know? And I was like, yeah, like, I'm looking at her going to do her junior cert. I was 8 months pregnant sitting in my junior cert, or 7 months. I remember I was quite big anyway. I had quite a big bump, you know.
And you did it, fair play to you.
And I did it. And, you know, it's really surreal then to look at her and go, you know, but do you know what? If she be in that same position as well, you just respond to whatever's happening. And my parents were amazing. They responded very well. My parents weren't used to the stuff that I was bringing to their door, right? You know, my mom was from a big family of 10 and from Finglas, so not unaware of hardship and unaware of, you know, like, living on a shoestring and stuff. And but there was never any really criminality or anything amongst, like, even though it was such a big family, and there was no addiction and there was nothing like that. And then on my dad's family, he does those four boys. They grew up in the tenements on Usher's Quay and then Ballyferma. And again, no drug use and no criminality.
Yeah.
You know, scutting on the back of a truck or something, you know, is the most you'd hear them talking about, that kind of stuff. So my dad, I used to mess calling him Mr. Moderation. So, you know, everything was okay in moderation. He tried to incentivize us not to smoke cigarettes. He said he'd get a loan out of credit union and give us £1,000 if we hadn't smoked by the time we're 16. And then he'd extend something to 18. And so what they were experiencing with me was extremely out of the ordinary for them.
Yeah.
you know? And I think that's why I'm always so strong on, you know, when they say, you know, where are the parents? You know, they must have been dragged up and, you know, all this. It's like, well, you know, your family unit is only one small part of the external forces within society that can drive you to anything or protect you from anything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I had two beautiful parents that done absolutely amazing by me, shocked that I was pregnant. And my dad left the room, kind of didn't say anything to me and left the room really disappointed in me. And I was really upset and he walked back in and he said, sorry, I shouldn't have walked off on you. And they just, and now I look at the skill set that I have. Mm. So if you look at me going to the library and making these certain decisions, and we can't not look also beyond the fact that I did have two parents that attempted to keep me safe. So yeah. I had an idea of what safety was.
Yeah.
Where so many families have also are struggling. My parents, my dad was a presser in a machine factory, and my mum was a machinist and worked in Uchea,
yeah,
doing thermostats. So even though we didn't have little, I still knew what it was to be safe.
Mm.
So that probably helped me make some positive decisions, even in those toughest of situations.
Just what you said there about your dad, it sounds like your parents, you know, I know you said to me before we started chatting that, your dad passed away a number of years ago, but and your mum, you're still very close to her to this day. It really do sound like they were and are brilliant people. And when you said that about your dad walking out of the room and coming back in like that, that's just very powerful. And that's what a man.
Yeah. And he grew up in Catholic Ireland. You know what I mean? He grew up, he was born in the 30s and, you know, and my mom would be from a somewhat Catholic family as well in terms of her parents. And, you know, so there was other people having very different experiences than me at that time. Like, I mean, it was the year 2000. You know, if that had been 10, 15 years before, you know, we all know like how that went for so many people. But I've no doubt that my mom and dad, regardless of any situation, does continue to pile on the supports. Yeah. And I think it shows then, I think when we isolate and abandon people, you push them to the fringes. My mom and dad came closer. Every time I tried to move, they came closer and they came closer. And that just continued. And I think that's probably what stands to me more than anything.
Yeah, wow. Because, I mean, you know, as we were saying, like, you know, drugs were part of your life. You know, you might have been, you know, robbing the odd time to get money, to get the drugs and whatever. But then when you found out you were pregnant, everything changed.
Yeah, I stopped taking drugs.
Yeah.
I've a strong will, apparently, I can see, like, because it's not easy to just stop taking drugs. So I always say that with a caveat because I don't judge other people who have struggled in that case. So I always want to say that, yes, I managed to do that. Yes, that's not the norm when people do have addictions. Do you know what I mean? But my mum used to smoke. I've no memory of her smoking, but when she met my dad, she stopped smoking. My dad was like a footballer and a ref, and he was all like, so he must have shamed her out of smoking. But she gave up smokes when she was really young, before she had us. But I always remember my mum talking about, you know, not drinking alcohol or not smoking during pregnancy and stuff. Now, she wouldn't have had any science to go with that. It was more just an innate thing, never a preachy thing, just a matter of fact thing. So I set quite easy into that structure, I suppose, of, you know, trying to maintain a healthy pregnancy.
Yeah.
Which helped me then because it meant that I disrupted the drug taking.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, I know it must have been a huge shock to the system being pregnant at 15. I mean, obviously your daughter is a blessing, but she really was.
Yeah.
In the sense that it was a catalyst for positive change in your life also.
Yeah. And that positive change is still happening in a sense because, you know, so much was endured and there was so many fractures, I suppose, in my early teens that molded many parts of how I also reacted to life. So even though I was making positive decisions, there was also, I carried a lot of anger, I carried a lot of hurt, didn't really understand it. Was quite hurt in a collective sense for my community and the amount of people dying. Every time I would see the church just rammed again and again and again for funerals of young people, I would think that I'm not a very individual person. I very much set myself into the identity of the collective of my community. Do you know what I mean? So I struggle to separate myself from what's happening in everyone else's lives, which can make it extremely difficult to to like go to sleep at night and not be going, how are we all going to, you know, be well and live happy lives and flourish, and, you know, and that's probably what led me to politics in the end as well, you know.
Well, you're clearly a very empathetic person.
Yes.
You know, so you really feel when you feel another person's pain.
Yeah. So even though the positive changes has happened during pregnancy in terms of interrupting the chaos,
yeah,
I still had a lot of hurt to walk through, right through my, you know, through my teenage years and through my 20s, and things continued to happen around me. But yeah, I definitely wasn't as chaotic as I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you do say it there, like about funerals. And I mean, you know, am I right in thinking funerals because of drug taking?
A little bit of everything.
Okay.
So for me, I look at funerals or the loss of life sometimes in communities that are like mine and similar to mine, in any sort of, especially urban spaces, is risk taking. Do you know what I mean? So tragic death, you know, whether it's road traffic, whether it's driving too fast, whether it's overdose, you know, whether it's mental health, and then there's also suicide. And so I've experienced kind of a death across of array of different things.
From an early age,
from around 13.
Okay. Wow.
And from many different things. But I think sometimes deaths can occur at a higher rate when the ability to assess risk or the ability to have a safety net, like, so you're very much living in the impulsivity of the moment sometimes in a community like that or in a space like that. And that can sometimes lead you to making decisions that will potentially end your life. But that's not the intention in that moment. Do you know what I mean? And it's trying to get past that, you know. And I think generationally, my age group at that time, there's a couple of generations across Tala that have had that condensed massively, you know, where there's some groups. So my group of friends have lost loads of friends. There's loads of us, you know. I count every month. I'm remembering, you know, two or three people across that month in my head, and I think about them and that. And then there's other. I look at young people now in my community that are going through the exact same, and they're burying friends. And I'm looking at their little Instagram pages, and they're sharing their pictures of their dead pals. And death becomes normal. So there's a stage even where I was impacted by death in a way that if a year had nearly passed where somebody hadn't died, I'm like, you're recognizing the absence of a death that year, where most people recognize recognize the presence of a death in their year.
Yeah,
I got to the stage where I was doing the inverse.
Whoa.
You know, which is hard.
Very sad.
Yeah, extremely.
Extremely,
yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And I suppose what you've been able to do for your own kids because of your own upbringing, because of your own experience, you were able to bring all of that learning to the table when you were parenting yourself.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important to go, like, when we're looking at supporting young people like I was, is supporting whole families. Because, you know, even though my parents had that level of stability, when you look at other parents, you can't separate them from their histories, and their histories might have been very different. So their histories might have been there was very like literacy issues, or, you know, even being able to advocate. You know, there's so many parents that are like the anxiety of even going to a parent teacher meeting. They care massively about their child's schooling, but they're absolutely petrified of sitting in a parent-teacher meeting and having a discussion because of the ability to advocate and the ability to let go of their own negative schooling experiences. And, you know, so I had parents that were in a quite stable position, but other parents cared as much as my parents. Like there was no, it wasn't that anyone cared any less, but the conditions in which they were living as well was also difficult. So everyone's house kind of had just something else, something different to contend with, I think, you know?
Yeah. So when your baby girl was born, it was obviously a joyous time.
It was.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
And she was born perfectly normal and gorgeous. And now she's a grown woman of 22. And she is flying it in her life.
She is.
Yeah, she's acting.
She's acting. So she's acting since she's 14. And her first film was actually set in Kilnarden. It was a film by Frank Berry called I Used to Live Here about cluster suicides.
Okay.
So quite hard hitting subjects that she knows well. Like, I mean, you don't grow up with a 15-year-old mother without being very close to the fringe with her, you know, because she was basically hanging around with me and my pals, you know what I mean, for large portions of her life, you know.
Yeah, I would imagine there was a lot of both growing up
together.
Together. And you and her dad have a great relationship.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really good. So, I mean, you had your folks, they were great support. You were navigating being 15, being a teenager yourself, all the changes you were going through yourself, and being responsible for this little baby.
Yeah.
That is full on.
Yeah. But it's mad. I think when you're that young and
just get on with it.
I think I was just getting on with it. Like, I think it would be wrong of me to look back and go, oh my God, that was so hard. Because actually, I don't think I had the capacity to digest if it was hard or not. Yeah. And I did have supports. And, you know, I did have like a mother and a father that very much co-parented with me. You know, she has a dad who loves her very much, who has had his own struggles in life, so we all try and mind each other. And, you know, and he has his family, which are quite involved in all the kids' lives on their side of the family. So it was always important to try and manage that and keep those supports there. So I definitely was very supported. And of course, moments were very difficult because I was managing my own stuff as well, also really wanting to be okay. Like, I wanted to be okay. I wasn't always okay. But yeah, I think it would be unfair for me to say, oh, I was found it extremely, extremely difficult, because I don't think I knew any different at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I suppose then a few years later, you then go into a program on Cusson, isn't that what it was called? Mm. It still exists?
It does.
So can you tell us a little bit about that and what, I suppose, what you did there?
Yeah, so at 16, I went into Cusson, which was an educational facility for women in the Tala West area. I had got a letter from the social welfare, I think, at the time, to say that there was like interviews, or they were sending me for an interview, and I think there was a small payment, which is small. I'm saying small now, it wasn't small, because it was like £30 or something at the time on top of your social welfare, which would have been a lot for me. And I went for the interview and I got it, but you could bring your child with you. So Rainbow House was the creche within the facility. So you were able to come, I think it was like 3 days a week or 4 days a week I was there. And I brought Jordan at one. She was one and she went in. And so she was getting what she needed in her day, and I was getting what I needed in my day. And I think it just really was crucial, I think, at that time, because I was 16, I wasn't going to go back to school. So it was like, well, what's going to happen now? Am I going to be at home? My parents both worked. So was I going to be at home, and or was I going to use, I suppose, what was being offered to me to be able to get some sort of an education, which I just took it. You know, and it really worked for me, but also the style, because school was too regimented. It was too blunt and forceful, and there's just something about the structural nature of school that doesn't work very well for me, or never worked very well for me. And in Ancassan, it was like soft furnishings, and the sofas were soft, and they were in a circle, and there was like, I remember the first day or in the first week, or I obviously have this image because the colours I remember sending out were like pink and purple satins and candles in the middle, and they put on meditation music before the class started to try and help us to come into the room. Now, I could not, like, I laughed and, you know, laughed under my breath the whole time. I was a child, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I just thought, this is mad. But over time, because I was there for 2 years, and I think that's why it's so important that the intervention was 2 years as well, because it takes time for your body and your senses to let that new way of anything in, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, like, regardless of the education I received there, it was the structure and the ability to just think for a moment, I think, that allowed me figure out what my next steps were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge part of your...
Yeah.
Like, I suppose, transformation.
Totally. Like, yeah. I think I look back now, and even though Ancassan is still there and it's doing work, we haven't replicated that across the country, and we really should be replicating situations like that, because what we're looking at, like, is, you know, now people are obsessed with, like, job activation, like, just activating women into jobs that are also just poverty wages, you know? Mm. So, like, and this less emphasis on this kind of community development style, healing, loving, trauma-informed approach to life and learning, which will ultimately take longer in the beginning, but in the long run, you know, kind of, is a feedback loop into society, because people are much happier and healthier for participating.
So you'd love to see more of these around the country.
Oh, 100%. I mean, especially with childcare. I mean, one of the biggest barriers is childcare. And Rainbow House was beautiful, and Jordan was there for 2 years. And, you know, it probably, like, she's an amazing artist. Her dad taught her to hold a pencil at a very, very young age, because he used to sketch. And now she has far out talented him at this stage. But he taught her how to use a pencil very young. So it meant she was sitting in a classroom and she was getting to colour and engage in art and, you know, be able to put paint on a page and have access to that very young. And then me to collect her, you know, or my dad used to collect her sometimes. Like, if I had something to do after Ancassan, he would walk. He was, like, retired pretty soon after I had her, or he was kind of reduced his hours. And sometimes he'd walk over and collect her and stuff. But my dad was gassed. Like, he, even when she went to school, like, he would show up at the school to collect her, and I'd be at the school going, I'm here to collect your dad. Like, and he was like, yeah, I know, but I'll collect her as well. Yeah. You know? So there was always just two. There was so many times it was just two of us. Or then her dad would show up as well. And it's like, all of a sudden there's three of us collecting her from school. Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So when did politics, or the idea of getting involved in society in that way, start to creep in?
So I first went into addiction. Working in addiction and developing addiction programs, and it kind of was probably going back to being in the library that day. I kind of returned to that a few years later and kind of thought, I actually am quite good at taking in information on a subject that I have keen interest in. I can take in a lot, and addiction seemed to be one of those. So I began to study addiction in IT Tala on a Wednesday evening, and then I got employed locally to develop a service for young heroin users. They had started using heroin at 13, 14. I was not that far ahead of them, you know, in terms of life. I was only 17, 18 at that stage, but I think that helped bridge that gap, I suppose, between services and young people.
Sure.
You know,
they were able to relate to
exactly.
She gets it.
Yeah. So from there, I just worked really hard. I was running my own service in Bluebell at the age of 21. And
wow.
So I was starting to see society then beyond my own community. And I was seeing that how my society was, or my community was set up, was also replicated in other urban parts of the country, especially because then I was in Bluebell, and then I was spending time in Fatima and Dolphin, mostly Southside kind of places, or, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, the Southwest or whatever it is. Anyway, I call all this side of the Liffey is just the Southside. Much to the dismay of Dublin 6. But so for me, I started again with my ability to observe and the questions and the why. And it's like, well, why is that like that? And why are they cutting off their funding there when we don't even get? And I started again that inquisitive nature of, you know, Alice Mary Higgins always says to me in the chamber, like, you know, you're such a detective. Such a detective. So I obviously just have that in me, you know, to kind of so examine things. So I done that. And then politics wasn't and still isn't something that I'm seeking out, you know, as a career. I think what I want
to do. I love that. Still isn't.
Yeah. what I want to do is I want people to just have, you know, equity of, you know, life, equity of being able to flourish. I don't want life to be a luxury for people. I don't want, you know, the way people are looked down on from communities like mine and how we're wrote about and how we're stereotyped and how it's generalized. You know, if one bad thing happens, it's like everyone is kind of it's just for me, it's just the wrong way around society. And I think it makes me, I've gone through different stages where before it made me angry, before I thought I could fix it. Then I thought, what's the point? So I go through all these different phases. Where I'm at now is it. Deep sense of, I think, sadness and concern. I'm 38 now, and I'm like, am I going to, not that I'm near death or anything, but it's like, am I going to spend another 38 years trying to do the same thing and seeing people who I love and care about, who others in society think are, you know, monsters sometimes. Is anybody really going to understand the connection between things? Like, is anyone really going to change things? Or will politics and policy always ultimately protect itself at the most affluent level, even if people have good intentions? So what I've learned over the last few years is there's plenty of politicians that are from, you know, the ruling parties that care and that have good intentions and goodwill. But then it stops there. So they can see it, they have the analysis, but then nothing happens. And I think that's what scares me.
They don't act on it.
Yeah. Enough. So I thought for a long time, if you just bring a level of consciousness across society, that will ultimately potentially change things. I think what I'm worried now is that that's not enough. So now it's like, well, what is next? A part of me looks and goes, you know, do you flip back into radical action? You know, is it radical? Is it ground up movements, demanding better, taking over streets, doing all of this? And then you look at what's happening in East Wall, which is not reflective at all of any sort of, you know, issue. That's people, that's disenfranchised people being whipped up into hate that they're not even applying an analysis to. So that's not the radical that I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you know, so now I'm just at this crossroads, whereas I'm in there 6 years. And I've brought people along on particular points. But now I'm starting to worry is it just enough for them? Do I just massage their consciousness enough by having me there to say these things exist? And that they're comfortable that they just, oh, well, Lynn is there, or Senator Flynn is there, or this person is here, or that person is here. So we know all those issues happen and we're going to agree with Lynn and we're going to say that is terrible that that's happening. Nobody should be living like that. But that's where it stops. That's where I'm at the minute.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And of course that would lead to huge frustration. And I can totally imagine that you were angry, and I wouldn't blame him if you were still angry, especially if you're fighting the fight all the time and you're saying these things all the time and you're asking for change and help.
Well, I think people conflict things, unfortunately. I think unfortunately, as a society, we don't give ourselves time to think well about situations. It's constantly reactive. So like for me, poverty is such a driving force in so many things. So like if you look at, like, if I speak out against, say, the treatment of people in the penal system, or like advocate for the spent convictions of people who've had convictions in their past, people don't stop enough to make the treads between, well, I'm not saying that crime is okay. I think people think, oh yeah, like, you know, the senator for, you know, wanting to like make everything legal or whatever. And it's like, well, no, like, crime is still a thing, it still happens. But if we actually want to end the thing that we both agree we prefer there's less of, you have to actually change the conditions which create them in the first place. And that's, you can't police your way out of those issues. Like we had the guillotine, like if you look at the guillotine around, like, you know, the guillotine, like people were murdered in front of everybody as a spectacle, you know, did that stop murder? It didn't. It just fed in the moment feeling of people that something was happening and somebody got what they deserved. Mm. But it didn't have a knock on effect of making sure there was never any murder again. People were just guillotined for their own kind of, you know, morphed sense of justice or something.
God, when you start looking at it like that, I suppose, I'll be honest, it's not something that I spend a huge amount of my normal day thinking about, because the truth is, and this is where I suppose, and you know, it's kind of uncomfortable even to say it, but I suppose I realise how privileged my own upbringing was growing up in the west of Ireland, where I didn't have to contend with a lot of what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think privilege comes in many ways, and there's nothing wrong with privilege. That's the thing. And I don't think we should make anyone feel in any way bad for their privilege.
No, sure. But I suppose it's important for us to be aware.
That's it. That's what I was going to say. So like you going, I'm aware that I've had, and other people, it's like, well, what do you do with the awareness? Do you know, do you use that awareness to continue the stereotyping of others that didn't have privilege?
Yeah.
And it's just about trying to tease those things out, you know. And I think power is a big part of this question. I mean, power comes in many, many ways, and it's highly concentrated within bureaucratic systems and administrative systems and social welfare systems and all these things. And those with the least power often don't necessarily know they've no power. So when they can exercise power in the wrong way, they do. They exercise it on each other in violence. They exercise on each other in criminality. They exercise it on migrants coming into an ESB building. So when you have little or no power, right, everyone wants to feel like they've agency and power. So they'll find a way to use that power, but in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. God, you open people's eyes to really taking a look at things. Like, it's probably not good enough for all of us just to kind of kick back and, you know, get on with things. It's important to look at it. And sometimes it's ugly to look at it, as in ugly by what I mean is that sometimes our own feelings on things, our own opinion on it, our own perception of it is a bit ugly.
Yeah.
That we think a certain way, as you said, even the most, you know, open-minded people can sometimes automatically go to stereotyping. Because we do, I think, we even if we think that we don't make assumptions, and I'm very open and I'm this and I'm that, but unfortunately sometimes assumptions can be made. And
but we all do. I do, you know.
Yeah, it's part of the human condition.
And I think there is a level of human conditioning to it. But I think one skill we have to learn is to not acting on a stereotype. So being able to
recognize
it as it's passing. Yeah. I'm stereotyping. I'm not going to let go of the fact that I still think that group of people do X, Y, Z. But what do you do with that? So it's when you begin to use your stereotypes to act as an obstacle to other people doing well, or to act as an oppressive tool, you know. So I think it's okay for people to be able to examine where and when they're stereotyping, and to not be kind of jumped on it.
Yeah, I suppose it's the whole reacting and responding thing, isn't it? And becoming very observant. You spoke about when you went into On Cusson First and there was like nice meditation music and it was, and you were like, what the hell's going on here? It's been mental. But did you get into that kind of thing? Because you just seem to me like somebody who's, when you're able to take that step back, sometimes a lot of people do that through being mindful, through those kind of practices that give you that sense of awareness of, maybe I'm not seeing the full picture here. Maybe I do need to take a breath and have a pause before I speak. Do you do anything like that? I'm just, as a matter of interest.
Yeah, I'm still quite reactive sometimes. I'm definitely less reactive than I was growing up. So I'm definitely, you know, developing all the time. And sometimes you loop back around, have
sure
to start again.
Same as all, yeah.
But I think Anne-Louise Gilligan, I'll always remember teaching me about visualization more so than even the meditative part of that kind of stuff. But so I don't meditate every day or anything, but I definitely think. I think there's something that we don't recognize about people is like congratulating people who can take time to just think and think well. And that's about like philosophical thought. And, you know, I developed some initiatives in communities, which is philosophy in the communities. And we run philosophy groups in Dolphin House, and we run them with people in recovery. And it's all that stuff about how can you think well.
Great.
So I try and do that. I try and take philosophical concepts down to a very just non-academic level. But I also remember Anne Louise doing visualization with us once in, they had a bunk, they had in the shanty, so their original home, they used to bus people, women, out of Tala West and in there to like have a secret education.
Right.
So their husbands would be in work, or some of them would be in domestic violence situations, or some of them would have no schooling, or so they would be back home and in the house before anyone arrived home. And they were having this kind of holistic, you know, experience of education before Ancasan was even built. So in sometimes you could, it was a thing called Isabella's Day, and they would bring you up there. And I went up there, and I remember her doing some visualization about an animal. And I think I have an imagination, which probably that style of stuff suited me better than the sitting, just the sitting in silence, where the visualization, where I could think about things, think about stories and narratives and futures and ideas and visions. So I remember there was something about an animal, and I remember I just kept thinking about this whale, this big whale, and I really, really lost myself in the visualization. I wasn't visualizing anything in particular in terms of like an outcome. It was just my mind was just visualizing everything, you know, and I really enjoyed that. So I remember from there on in, I used to do try and visualize the potential that I could have in the world. And I used to visualize being in a certain job, knowing I was too young, but going, yeah, but like if you were in there, you do this and you do that. And I think that gave me a false sense of confidence then in interviews, because I'd already walked through what it would be like to be in that job. So I'd, you know, it's a bit of, you know, you're kind of manipulating yourself, to, you know, in a sense. But I remember I used to visualize running off into the mountain, because we live on the foot of the mountain. And when I would start to feel panic or start to feel down, and I would have periods throughout my whole life of like, you know, low mood for a period of time, but all very manageable in a sense, or just being used to it, I suppose. But I used to visualize running up the mountain and into like this big long grass, you know, like the yellow corn grass nearly, and just sitting on the ground and the grass, the kind of stems being way up over my head, and just staying there for a little while. So I, in that visualization, I used to be letting out like pain and crying and da 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 da, but I was in the thing. And I don't know where that visualization came from. I don't know whether Anne Louise asked us to visualize something that day where we felt safe, and that's what I'd conjured up. But I continued to use that over a period of time, and I still sometimes do now. I just don't talk about them. They're all very, I just do them kind of privately and quietly, like, do you know what I mean? Like if I'm in the chamber and I really disagree with what someone is saying, I haven't, there is a narration in my head where I literally narrate my response to them a few times before I've even stood up. Do you know? So I've kind of,
because if you don't do that, you'll react, isn't it? You'll be snappy.
You know, so I narrate it. So I think I've a potential just to narrate things that are about to happen, and then also visualize things that can keep me safe.
You've such a deep awareness of who you are. And I suppose, you know, your childhood went at supersonic speed because of the environment and everything that happened to you, getting pregnant young and all the rest. But, you know, you have clearly done a lot of work on yourself as well. And I know through the process of writing the book, a lot of stuff came up. We didn't even really get into it, but I know you've spoken about rape. And that was obviously, I would imagine, a very tough thing to do, to actually go there and be willing to share that with everyone. But, you know, you spoke about Miriam at the beginning, and Miriam Margulies being somebody who was truly authentic and owning who they are. And it's like, this is who you are. Like this, the name of this podcast is Ready to Be Real. And I love talking to people. I love having different conversations, and people from, I say it at the beginning, all walks of life. And that's what it's about. And I love when somebody sits unashamedly embracing who they are and fully this is me. You have made such a brilliant difference so far. And like, you're only what, 6 years as a senator?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're 38. Mm. There's a long, long, long life ahead. I can just see you still continuing to make such a positive difference, regardless of whether it is, whether that's you staying in politics or not, but through you being you and now, I suppose, expressing your creativity and sharing your message in whatever way you do, I think it's going to only have a positive impact on all of us. So I'm just really grateful to you.
Thank you.
Absolutely loved this conversation. You're an amazing person and it's been such a privilege to meet you.
Thank you, Sheila. I enjoyed it very much. Very philosophical in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. My favourite kind of chats. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends, family or on social media. And you can support what I do in all the usual ways by clicking follow, giving a rating or leaving a little comment. Thanks a million. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.